morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Kyle McNeil. I represent the estate of Oneida Green. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
The defendant's position in this case is a conclusion in search of a reason. Every statutory and doctrinal basis that they've relied upon, beginning in the circuit court and now coming up through the petition for appeal stage and now at this stage, that they've relied upon to support their position has turned out not to work. Judicial estoppel doesn't work. They don't even try to defend that. The claim splitting bar doesn't work. The double recovery bar doesn't work. Section 80156 doesn't work as a matter of its plain language. So what we're left with is a situation where these defendants are trying to use what happened in Kentucky from which they have suffered no prejudice. In fact, what happened in Kentucky can only help them by virtue of providing a credit against any of their future, any of their potential liability.
So you do accept that there's a potential credit if there were a judgment against them?
There would be we accept that 801.35.1 would operate to say that 801.35.1 and the alternative to the double recovery doctrine, which is what's expressed in the Wilkins case about management of a verdict of a judgment after a verdict, would say that we can't recover the same damages from two different defendants. We can't recover, and how that would come about in this case would be the medical bills.
No, it's not the same damages. It's for the same claim. It doesn't say anything about damages.
Are you talking about 801.35.1?
Yes, I am.
Well, and so that's why it's unclear to me whether this comes from 801.35.1 or from just the doctrine that this court discussed in the Wilkins case about just. It's not about double recovery. That wasn't a double recovery. It's just you manage the verdict. You manage the judgment after a verdict to make sure that there's not double recovery of the same damages, the same element of damages.
It's governed by the statute, which is dealing with multiple tortfeasors, and you have settlement with some and not others, and you have a pro tanto credit generally. Actually, my question was a friendly question.
Understood.
It seems to me that what your best argument is, and tell me if I'm overestimating what you're saying, is that Virginia law has a way of dealing with these problems. It's not quite as convoluted as the way it came up to us in this case. It's simply a pro tanto credit. Whatever you got in Kentucky, it's the same cause of action. It gets reduced from the defendant's judgment in Virginia. Is that the way Virginia law handles the problem, or is there a different or better way for Virginia law to handle the problem?
That would be the way Virginia law handles the problem if both cases were under Virginia law, because then you'd be dealing with claims that provide recovery for the same elements of damages.
So suppose you get $500,000 in the Virginia case. What happens to the money you got in Kentucky?
You would look to see, okay, what comprises the money we got in Kentucky? And that would be medical bills. That would be the pain and suffering of the decedent.
Would that be true if you had two cases in Virginia? One case against defendant set X, and the other case against defendant set Y. And the first case you got $100,000 in settlement, and the second case you got a judgment of $200,000. You would say we'd go line by line and say, well, I didn't make this claim here, I didn't make that claim there. It all was the same cause of action. I just had different items of damage. You would go damage by damage for the pro tanto credit.
I don't think so in that case, because then both the claims are identical in terms of the damages that were recoverable. I don't think you would peel back the onion on that one.
So
but in this case,
I'm heading to is where would this go if you win this case on appeal? And it would confuse me if you win this case on appeal and go back to the Virginia court and get a judgment. And they say, well, survivor damages is different from wrongful death damages, and here are the distinctions, so I get to have both. Because then there's really nothing in Virginia law that protects against the risk of this anomaly, and it is quite an anomalous circumstance on your part as well as their part.
I think our position is a middle ground, Your Honor, which is that Virginia law says in a wrongful death case that you get these X kinds of damages, A, B, C, D, and E. And the best example I can come up with in this case is that you get the recovery for the son's loss of solace, loss of the kindly services of his mother. Those are never recoverable under Kentucky law.
So, and so what you're saying, the survivorship money you got in the settlement in Kentucky is never going to act as a pro tanto credit in Virginia because you don't have a survivorship claim in Virginia. Is that where all this is heading?
I'm saying the way I envision this happening is they would get a credit for a portion of the Kentucky settlement.
What portion? Because survivorship under, I think, your theory is a different claim than wrongful death. And technically it is.
It is a different claim. In this situation, it compensates. There is some degree of overlap in the types of damages that those claims compensate. And there are things that don't overlap. So I don't think that under this court's either under 801.35.1 or under this court's the way this court analyzed it in the Wilkins case, you do look at what damages were actually compensated, and we net those out against each other.
Let me ask you this: what authority do you have for claiming or saying that the court is going to look at what damages were compensated in order to determine an offset under 35.1?
I don't have a case that says that. I think that's how I saw this court do it, in the Wilkins case.
But that's a double recovery case. That has nothing to do with settlements. Doesn't need to be. It's just a common law doctrine. You can't recover the same dollar twice.
Right. I think that would have to carry through.
Well, the statute goes far beyond that.
Which one, 35.1?
Yeah, it's directed to the cause of action, which is a much broader concept than an item of damage.
Right, and I think it's just it is complicated by the fact that we're talking about, I think, two different sovereign created causes of action. We're not shooting at the same target with that 35.1 kind of envisions. So I think I could intellectually justify getting up and saying, exactly making the argument that you're suggesting. I could justifiably and intellectually say, no, it's completely different causes of action. 35, I recovered for X claim in Kentucky. That has nothing to do with the Virginia claim. They don't get any credit for it. 35.1 doesn't apply to it because it's completely different causes of action, completely different claims. I think I could justifiably say that.
It would stress out all the other doctrines, and there's like a half a dozen of them going on here, looking for some sort of response to the anomaly of all this.
Right, I think that's the reason why why we're willing to concede that they would get that this court's double recovery. I think the best place to look is the way this court has said what isn't double recovery, and instead what you do when there's multiple claims, and it doesn't have to be across state lines. You could have a case that has federal claims and state claims, and arises out of the same set of operative facts, the same conduct. And the federal claims could say you get damages A, B, C, and D, and the state claim says you can get damages D, E, F, and G. And I don't think anyone would say that if you got a recovery on both claims, and you submitted evidence on the damages for both claims, that you'd be able to get, where there's overlap, that you'd be able to get that D twice.
Right, but no one's arguing that. That's a given.
Right.
The question is where you don't have overlap, but the non-overlapping subsets of damages are encompassed in the same cause of action.
Our point here, I think, and I may be misunderstanding your question, Your Honor, there is some overlap here between the damages that are compensated by, just like there's overlap in my hypo between the federal and the state claims.
But it's a given that you don't get that. We only need a statute to tell us that. Common law tells us that. You can't get the same buck twice.
Right, and that's what I'm conceding. I don't get the same buck twice. It's just that here, the wrongful death verdict will by virtue of 801.54, say to the husband, X, to the son, Y, for medical bills, Z, for funeral expenses, A, for loss of income. It'll break all that down. So we'll know how much each thing is. And you shouldn't get, and by virtue of what was gotten in Kentucky, which is just the pain and suffering of the decedent, which isn't anywhere on that 80154 verdict list here in Virginia, and which is the medical bills, which is on that verdict list, that somehow all of what happened in Kentucky gets netted out against what comes down the pike in Virginia.
I see where you're going. The medical bills are you don't get the same buck twice, but you get all the pain and suffering and survivorship, and it's not a pro tanto credit at all in Virginia.
Correct. That would be our position, is that is the best way, again, to address what your honor has correctly described, is an anomaly, a weird situation caused by a somewhat weird set of facts, but that frankly you could see happening anywhere along the border.
Yeah, but it's an anomaly produces a gigantic windfall for you, because in a normal situation under Virginia law, you can't do survivorship and simultaneously do wrongful death. That is the public policy of Virginia. Our statute states it.
Yeah, and no one is asking Virginia law to provide both. Well, no one is asking for Virginia law to give us both.
I think the problem with your theory is going to be the wording of 35.1, honestly.
And I think because 35.1 envisions claims all brought under the same set of laws, and that are governed by the same set of laws. This is a law school exam hypo. There's a choice of conflict of law, not a conflict of laws issue, but it's just there's two sets of laws that govern, and so I don't think it's I very strongly push back against the concept that this is a windfall. This is just the result of our federal system. Different states can do things different ways. We had to proceed under the auspices of two different states here.
Sometimes there's benefits, sometimes there's drawbacks.
Yes.
Same way the cookie crumbs.
You could come up with a fact pattern in which we would, depends on, different cases, different states have different caps on what are recoverable under, with economic damages, non-economic damages. Virginia has a cap, Kentucky doesn't. North Carolina has an even different cap on that kind of thing.
You're down to get 3 minutes.
Understood. So, yes, there could be a windfall one way or the other, or defendants one way or the other could get a windfall under different sets of facts.
Perhaps under these facts as well.
My takeaway from that is we don't know what that is yet.
That's your best response is we're going to have to deal with the portanto issue some other day.
Exactly. The right answer is not to say you don't go forward at all. The right answer is to say, see what happens with the verdict, then engage in the analysis where you actually have the facts. I assume they're going to try to get the settlement agreement from the Kentucky case, that they're going to try to get our demand from the Kentucky case to see what was recovered. Then the this trial court will be in a position to actually make a decision based on facts rather than at the outset snuffing this thing out. So we believe the court should be reversed.
All right. Thank you.
I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
All righty.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is John Jesse. I represent Dr. Rodriguez Pometel and his professional association, Laparoscopic Surgery. My colleague, Daniel Suero, will be speaking on behalf of the other defendants in this case, and we ask the court to reserve half our time for Mr. Suero.
All righty.
Where the defense views this case is that the plaintiff is attempting to violate what has been Virginia law for as long as there has been the right for wrongful death in Virginia. And that is, this court and our General Assembly has said there is either a recovery for personal injury damages or a recovery for wrongful death.
But surely Virginia law applies in Virginia. And what we're talking about is something that didn't happen in Virginia.
Everyone agrees this is a Virginia law case. Every party has conceded that. We submit that simply because an action took place across state line, a settlement for personal injury, that does not mean that Virginia has a blinder, and that Virginia doesn't deal with what the fundamental principle is for wrongful death statutes in Virginia, and that is the recovery is an either-or. It's an alternative.
But in Virginia, but it's not the case in other jurisdictions, and Virginia is quite respectful of the concept of federalism and the independent sovereignty of states.
Well, the statute that addresses this, of course, is 8.0156, and in that it talks about the injury. It doesn't talk about defendants. It doesn't talk about locations for people to be. It talks about recovery for an injury. And whether someone receives a recovery by settling in one state and now argues, well, what we really are doing is some special code, and now the circuit court judge or the jury has to sit down and apply that code.
Could the plaintiffs have sued the Kentucky defendants in Virginia?
I think they could. These are people on the border. I license in other states, and I have defended Virginia doctors in West Virginia because they are relatively close to the border and under the long-arm statutes of that state. I submit that if doctors are treating patients from across state line, that has been used as a nexus, at least in the cases I have defended in West Virginia, to say there are the minimal contacts
needed. But the Kentucky defendant's conduct was alleged negligence in Kentucky, right?
The defendant, they've alleged a continuum of negligent conduct, beginning in Virginia, going through Kentucky, and of course the patient eventually dies in Tennessee, which could bring in other issues.
Did they allege that Kentucky defendants committed negligent torts in Virginia?
They did not allege they committed torts in Virginia. They alleged a continuous tort that dealt with both Virginia doctors and Kentucky
doctors. And you think the long-arm statute would have drug them into Virginia?
Well, I think so, and it's not necessarily so much on the individual case, Your Honor, as on what their minimal contacts are. They're treating Virginia patients. They're on the border. That has been what's been used in the cases I've defended in other states for doctors from Virginia, based upon their minimal contacts, not just in a particular case, although here is an individual who comes from Virginia, crosses the border into Kentucky, and receives treatment, and the patient then returns to Virginia. The bottom line is Virginia has all... Yes, ma'am.
You asked the trial court, and I believe the trial court decided this case under 56?
Yes, yes, ma'am.
Am I correct that the pleading here in Virginia was filed after the victim died?
Yes, ma'am. They all were filed in both instances.
Then how does 56 even apply? Doesn't that anticipate a suit filed while the person is alive and then the person dies?
Your Honor, I don't think so, and I think the continuing decisions by this court, Centra Health is the perfect example, have never raised that distinction. And there's no intellectual reason to say it, that, oh, well, if you filed suit the day before you died, therefore you get a double recovery. If you file suit your estate after you die, there's only a singular recovery. There's no intellectual basis and no fundamental reason under Virginia law, and no case that this court or other courts that I'm aware of has ever made that distinction in the statute. The Centra Health case is maybe the classic one where the suit was filed afterwards. The case was allowed to go forward under both claims, but then at the end, the jury had to decide, is this a personal injury recovery or is this a wrongful death recovery? And the court was so specific in saying, these are really different and we don't want these to overlap. It's so different that you want to bifurcate this case because the factual issues are totally different and there's no way that the patient should be able to recover for both. And that's their ultimate holding. We submit that the plaintiff has conceded all these points, conceded that this could not have happened if he had filed suit in Virginia for survivorship and then filed suit. And we submit that there's no real intellectual difference in this. Our court says damages for the injury, and it's an alternative. It is not a conglomerate.
You're clearly right about the way the statute works, but it's a huge, huge assumption to presuppose the statute was meant to apply to a foreign state's judgment. That's the part I'm not understanding about the argument you made.
Your Honor, as I understand the statute, it sets forth what can be recovered for an individual injury. And that's why everyone agrees this is an individual injury. So the question is, if I recover in Bedford, could I recover in Richmond? No. There's no intellectual difference. There's nothing in the statute. There's not a single case cited.
What about the intellectual difference of separate sovereigns? Kentucky is a separate sovereign with the right to have whatever law they like or don't like.
And they do, and we don't question that one bit. But the plaintiff elected to recover for personal injuries and not wrongful death. Collected one of the two things that our law allows in an alternative, not in a conglomerate. And the fact that it happened across state lines means that what Kentucky law does is perfect. But Kentucky law should not influence what Virginia has said.
One last question. Why isn't the Protanto credit enough for you? Why isn't that, assuming you get the broader view of it as opposed to what's being advocated, why isn't that the proper response Virginia should give to this anomalous and very sui generis circumstance?
And that certainly has never been raised by the plaintiff. The plaintiff has created that formulaic method that, well, let's look at West Virginia law, let's look at Tennessee law, let's look at Kentucky law, and then the jury decides, well, did you get that or did you not get that? And if they write their settlement in certain ways. So that issue has never been brought up or argued, but that obviously is a is an approach that might be a reasonable approach. I
All right.
See, my time is up, and I thank you so much.
May it please the court, my name is Daniel Sorrell, and I am here on behalf of the other appellees, Diagnostic Imaging, and one of their employed radiologists, Kasim Rao.
Counsel, let me just jump right into the end of your co-counsel's presentation, where he said that might be a reasonable alternative. I already am thinking of this as green one, because if you all don't settle it, I think we're going to see green, too, if, in fact, we find for the appellant here. But as I'm listening to this, it occurs to me that we can't decide all of the issues today. Some of my colleagues may disagree. Because, number one, we don't know what's in that settlement. And, number two, we don't know what a jury would do in Virginia. But if we allow it to go back for trial on some theories with some damage, certain claims, certain damages, we don't yet have an answer. We can't presume an answer to some of these questions. I think it would almost certainly have to come back when all of the parts of the equation are in front of us. So do you agree with what your co-counsel said, that that might be a reasonable alternative?
The court can
the pro tanto credit.
As articulated in the prior discussion, there's no need to engage in a pro tanto credit question right now because the framing is incorrect.
Well, we've been doing it for about the past 20-some minutes, so humor us.
No.
If we decide that's the direction to go, would that be a reasonable alternative?
Which aspect of the pro tanto, weighing both survivorship versus wrongful death within the same action, is that what the court?
Just speaking for myself, I don't know yet.
Okay.
I'm trying to tease through what the different avenues are that this could take.
Certainly, Your Honor. The reason the court can decide this case today is because it has been conceded. The superstructure upon which this case is built is we have a single indivisible injury by joint tortfeasors, and significantly, the plaintiff by appellant's own acknowledgement has already recovered wrongful death. The appropriate question under Virginia law for double recovery is not, let's examine the various...
Did you say already recovered wrongful death?
I'm sorry, already recovered survivorship in Kentucky. I apologize, Your Honor. Once it's clear that the patient's estate has already recovered survivorship damages in Kentucky, this court need not engage in what was referred to as the netting out of the specific damages. And what's being talked about is, for example, medical expenses or lost wages, loss of solace, etc. The threshold question, the estate can never get past. The threshold question is, there is a menu of survivorship damages. There's also a menu of wrongful death damages. We know for a fact that in this case, the estate has recovered the patient's pain and suffering. The direction that the appellant would like this court to go would require a total departure from this court's jurisprudence for many, many years, and that is, for every injury, there's but one recovery. So the right way to look at double recovery is not, in our view, to look at netting out what Kentucky's...
But survivorship and wrongful death would not be double recovery except for stuff like medical bills, because pain and suffering has nothing to do with a wrongful death claim.
It would be a double recovery under Virginia's law about the requirement that you must take that fork in the road under Mullins. So the double recovery here, by a esteemed colleague from the other side, is, are we getting paid for the same thing twice?
But you might want to slow your roll on that, because it seems like to me the double recovery would be because it's for the same claim. These are tortfeasors, joint tortfeasors for one claim. So anything that they get would be some more payment for the same claim. It would be a double recovery. But we have a statute to take care of that by allowing an offset.
Under subsection 2, I believe, of 8.0135.1, the court's exactly right, that there is a credit system built, but it's for personal injury or wrongful death, which is built into that statute as it is through all of this court's cases, which say you must pick. And so the invitation from the appellant is to have the court, either the judge or the jury, at the trial level sort of suss out the different specific items that are being awarded. However, if it is conceded, and it is here, that the estate has already received a recovery for the decedent's pain and suffering, there is no way to square that scenario with allowing this case to go to a verdict in Virginia on wrongful death.
There is one way, and their argument is very simple. Their one-way argument is, if you get the survivorship award in a Virginia court, the Virginia statute applies to that, involving Virginia defendants. And their response is, we didn't get a judgment in a Virginia court, we didn't make a Virginia claim, we're governed by Kentucky law, and we sued Kentucky defendants for torts in Kentucky. That seems like a pretty powerful comeback to me.
Except that Virginia deals with the same injury. Mr. Jesse is totally correct that you look at the analysis is, what injury are we looking at? It would be an extraordinary thing for the idea to go forward that depending on which side of the line you sue, for example, you may be able to get wrongful death and survivorship damages in cases that finish in Virginia. There were ways that this could have been done.
Do you also believe that Kentucky defendants could have been sued under the long-arm statute in Virginia?
I do, Your Honor. It is not conceded, and we don't believe that it is true, that it is impossible for a Kentucky court to exercise personal jurisdiction over Virginia defendants. In this case, no court undertook that analysis because that was never tried.
I was asking the opposite. Kentucky defendants in a Virginia court, thus subject to 8.0156.
It just depends factually. What were the contacts? What analysis on the ground? What was going on with the patient? Was the patient traveling back and forth across the state line receiving care? Irrespective of whether or not the appellant was sort of forced to make a choice, and we don't believe that they were. They filed both actions in both states.
But not against the same defendants.
But it's still correct. But in both situations, they just decided to file in both states where they could have taken other alternatives. They could have, under 433, done a serial litigation.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
You have 1 minute and 57 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. And unless the court has any further questions, there's only one point that I wanted to address, and it's Justice Powell's question about the operation of 8.0156. There's been some confusion or some about whether 8.0156 applies to a case like this where the suit wasn't filed until after the death. And they say, well, Mullins says, well, yeah, it still applies. 8.01 still applies, even though everything about the text of it says it shouldn't. Central Health versus Mullins says code section 8.0156, which in part governs the maintenance of a pending personal injury action as a survival action following the death of the plaintiff. So 8.0156, by its terms,
discusses cases where there was a claim pending before the death. You know how I know that? Because 80125 says the same thing. 80125 cross-references back to 80156. So 80156 isn't where the election of remedies doctrine comes from in Virginia. It comes from the fact that 80150 exists and 80125 exists. Because at common law, neither of them existed. And so now Virginia statute has said, okay, you have an 80150 cause of action if these elements are met. The tortious conduct causes death. You have an 80125 action if the tortious conduct didn't cause death. So that's where the election of remedies doctrine comes from in Virginia. It's not, it doesn't, 80156 is not the font of it. 80156 just closes the loop on it and expresses it for those cases where there was a claim pending and then there was death.
It's a civil procedure type statute.
It's a procedural statute, not a substantive or not a claim creating statute or anything like that. It just says, okay, in such cases, in those kinds of cases, you still only have the either or remedy. That those cases aren't somehow special because I had a PI claim pending, then I died. I should get both, because you can see someone making that argument. It says, no, you can't make that argument. It just kind of closes the loop that's created by 80150 and 80125. If the court has no further questions, we would submit it to the court and ask the court reverse.
Thank you very much. The court will be in recess until 10:50.
All right.
Oh, yeah.